failure, unbreakable security by breaking things. Security teams want to prevent incidents, but what if controlled breaking prevents catastrophic failures? Drawing from aviation safety, chaos engineering, and resilience design, discover why unbreakable security comes from breaking things on purpose. Learn to transform incident culture from blame to learning, implement controlled failure practices, and build psychological safety that turns near misses into competitive advantages. This talk will be held by Jelle Niemann-Sverdrit, which I ask to come on stage, please. Just a few words about Jelle, but also he will say something about himself very soon. Serial security paradigm breaker with deep roots in incident response and breach investigations. After leading security teams at Microsoft, Deloitte, Verizon, and Fox IT, Jelle's on a mission to break down the traditional department of no and build security that works with humans. And everything else, I think he will tell you himself. There you go.
Thank you. I've got this one, so even easier. Your phone.
Thanks.
So raise your hand if you still remember how it was to learn riding a bicycle. And keep your hand up if somebody taught that to you by first explaining that how the gyroscopic effect of rotating wheels creates angular momentum that resists changes to the axis of rotation. Well, that is kind of weird that it's only so few of you, because that is literally how bicycles work. But of course, that's not how we learn to ride a bike, right? So how did you learn it? Probably most of us, somebody was holding the back of the seat, you were wobbling, maybe panicking a little bit, almost fell, and then suddenly your parent maybe running behind you, you were flying, and you had mastered how to ride the bike. And the thing that nobody ever tells you is that you actually are continuously almost falling. Every single moment on the bike is a controlled fall. You actually constantly making those tiny corrections, those tiny failures, tiny recoveries. And the bike doesn't work because you don't fall. No, it actually works because you are continuously falling and you have learned to fall better. And cybersecurity has spent 30, maybe 40 years trying just to build training wheels that never are removed from the bike. We analyze every component, we test every part, we write 400-page policies, we train people on proper bicycle operation procedures, and then we wonder why they all keep falling over or don't even dare to get on the bike in the first place. So let's look into the cybersecurity equivalent of riding a bicycle. So build security that prevents that works not by preventing every wobble, no, by becoming actually really good at wobbling. I have investigated security incidents for almost 20 years. As said in the intro, I worked for Fox IT, for Verizon, Deloitte, Microsoft, and when you are so deep in that, what is happening, oh crap, something is wrong side of the house, yeah, then you start to think that is the most important element of security, preventing the bad outcomes. And I would argue that it is still very much a dominant line of thinking in our field. Stay out of the newspaper. And on one hand, we regularly kick in open doors like it's not about if you get breached, but when, or the even better, there's two types of companies, the ones that have been breached and the ones that don't know about it yet. Whenever there's a headline like the one you see on the slides, we're actually also the first ones to roll up our sleeves, fire up our mouths, and start some Monday morning quarterbacking on analyzing what the victim companies have done wrong and what we think they could have done better. Huh? They must have had it coming. If they only had triple factor quantum and phishing resistant authentication, oh, and if they had just patched everything, if only I were in charge, this would never have happened. Thanks, Captain Hindsight. And these are, to me, are symptoms of what in safety science is often referred to as work as imagined. This assumption that systems are designed in a perfect way, that people are trained to operate them exactly as instructed, and then in an almost mathematical or binary sense of logic, if something then goes wrong, then it must have been that the system was wrong, or even worse, that the person did something wrong, and then we have human error. So whenever something happens that we label as an incident in hindsight, then we tend to go back in time until we find a person with their hands on the keyboard, and somebody did then something that in hindsight we label to be incorrect, and then we say, okay, we found the culprit, we add more rules, we add more instructions, we add more controls, we add more awareness training. And it's all meant to sort of fix the human, to legislate or train square pegs into round holes, or to confuse people with even more warning signs and instructions, like the ones on the slide, which is actually a bridge very close to my house, which seems to be the most dangerous bridge in Amsterdam if you look at the signs. So you kind of feel where I'm going with this, right? This never works. I think many of us intuitively feel this from our own experience. That, but there is actually further research that also underpins this gut feeling that actually maybe preventing everything is not feasible. And in fact, even on the contrary, or paradoxically, even a healthy dose of incidents might actually be beneficial. Dave Snowden, researcher from Wales, worked for IBM at the time. He developed what's called the Kinefin framework, where you see sort of a short summary of on the slide. And what this framework tries to distinguish is between different sort of modes of operations of systems. And then I don't mean IT systems, but systems in a broader, more overarching perspective. And what we should acknowledge is that a lot of the work that we do is actually playing in what he calls the complex system. And those types of complex systems have very relevant and very interesting characteristics that we actually don't apply enough, if you ask me. Because what happens in those complex systems is something that people also sometimes refer to as the butterfly effect. This notion that a small change can lead to a big effect. Or on the contrary, a big change is maybe dampened out and leads only to a very small overall effect. Or even the same change happening twice can lead to two completely different outcomes. And what you see overall with these complex systems is that the behavior of that system as a whole cannot be predicted by just looking at all the individual components, at all the building blocks. It's not some sort of conveyor belt where we say, okay, this is the input, this is what we do, this is what's going to come out of it at the end of the line. No, it's only the interaction between all the different components that determines what happens to the system as a whole. And you can retrospectively, after the fact, you can try to describe and you can often understand what happens, but it is very hard to predict what will happen beforehand. So keep this notion in mind, these complex systems and their behavior. There's some examples, not necessarily cybersecurity, that demonstrate this really nicely. One is what's called the Cobra effect. This was named after a measure that was taken in India when it was still under rule by the Brits. And some of the cities were suffering from a large number of cobras, and of course people being bitten, being attacked by these snakes. So the British government came up with a measure. They said, okay, we want to get rid of this problem, we're going to award a bounty for every dead cobra that is handed in to us. That worked for a while. People were killing cobras, they were handing over the skins, they were being rewarded. Until a few entrepreneurial spirits started to say, maybe there's actually some money to be made in this cobra business. They started to breed cobras, creating little cobra farms, handing over, essentially killing them straight away, handing in the skins, making even more money. And of course the government was like, no, this is not how we intended this. They canceled the program, and these cobra farmers were like, oh yeah, then I don't need a cobra farm anymore. They opened the gates, released the cobras, and ended up ultimately with more cobras in the wild. Or another example, maybe a little bit closer to home and closer to present day. What we do here in the Netherlands is how we deal, or how we deal with empty cans, empty drinking cans. Here in the Netherlands, there's now a deposit, a small amount of money that you get in return when you return your empty can to the supermarket. Machines are often broken. Deposit is, for many people, not high enough to warrant returning it or to warrant the effort, so they throw it in the bin anyway. And what you see is that people are now going through trying to open the public trash cans, taking out the cans and to return them to the supermarket, but of course leaving all the other rubbish on the street. So a measure that was meant to reduce litter is now actually leading to more rubbish on the street. Again, you see the system is more than just the sum of the components. You cannot just look at all those individual well-intended measures and assume they will behave exactly as you want. And this type of linear thinking, or wishful thinking maybe even, has actually been around for a long time. In safety science, where I will keep borrowing from throughout the talk, there's been a concept that known as Heinrich's pyramid or Heinrich's triangle or iceberg, different ways to refer it, which was developed around the 1930s. This was named after researcher Mr. Heinrich, not surprising, who worked for an insurance firm. And what he did, he was analyzing insurance claim that is for related to accidents in the workplace. And he found a number of things. The first notion was that 88% of accidents were caused by what he was labeling as man failure. So essentially saying somebody not complying to instructions or training, human error. Keep in mind, most of those claims were actually filled out by managers, not by the people who were affected by the accidents. But another notion that has really been sort of almost following this science for a long time was that he was looking also at the seriousness, the impact of these incidents. And he found a pattern, what this pyramid is labeled after, where you have at the bottom, you have 300 incidents with hardly any injury. Then in the middle, you have 29 with minor injuries, a little bit more serious. And at the top, you have one with serious injuries or maybe even fatalities. And he concluded that there was some sort of linear relationship between those two. He said, okay, we need to prevent all incidents. We need to shrink the base of the pyramid, because if we reduce the number of small incidents, we'll have fewer minor injuries and fewer serious accidents. This notion that there will ultimately then be that will be the good way to deal with incidents in the workplace. This has been very prevalent for a long time. You see this in factories, this notion, we aim for zero incidents, often a counter how many days the factory has already been running without an incident or without an accident. But in the 90s, there started to emerge more research that started to contradict this line of thinking. And first it was more sort of anecdotal, some very serious accidents in companies that had stellar safety records. If you look at the number, at those counters, those no incidents at all perspective. So that was more sort of anecdotal. But there was other research being conducted in Finland where they looked at all incidents in the construction industry over a long period of time, over a period of almost 15 years. And they were trying to sort of prove this causal, this linear relationship that Heinrich was describing. So, and they looked at all these construction accidents over time, and they were saying, okay, if Heinrich's theory still holds, then we would expect this kind of relationship. If there's more incidents, we also expect more serious incidents and maybe even more fatalities. This is what the theory stated. What they found was actually completely the opposite. They found organizations that have more incidents have actually fewer serious incidents. Very paradoxical relationship that they were finding here. And yeah, what they were essentially saying is, okay, so it looks like the same things that hurt people are not necessarily the same things that kill people. And there is value in having a sort of a healthy dose of incidents, because that apparently gives you some sort of, yeah, maybe awareness, some sort of signal on what is happening. And it apparently somehow prepares your organization to be better ready, to be better prepared for whenever something serious is along the corner. So this emerged further, and this has grown into what in the safety discipline is now being labeled as a movement from safety one to safety two. And this is essentially what you could say is traditional safety to resilience. And some of the characteristics of safety one, the more traditional approach, is that it's very much this old-fashioned thinking of we want to prevent things from going wrong. And with that, like Heinrich stated, people are the problem. They need to be trained. They need to make sure that there's no variability in how they do the work. And if something goes wrong, then we have to find the culprit, we have to blame them, and we have to fix it, or maybe even fire it in many instances. Safety two, resilience thinking, more in line with, for example, that Finnish research, is then more focused on ensuring that things actually go right. And with that, keeping in mind that people are the solutions there. The people on the sharp end who are doing the actual work, they often have the right skills, the right experience to do work in the right way. And with that, accept that variability will happen if something goes in an unexpected way. Have a culture where you learn from that and where you then adapt for the future. This is not always how we in our field work, right? We still apply a lot of linear patterns, a lot of component kind of thinking in the way we design and test and talk about the systems. If we can only disrupt the attacker before they reach the final stage of the kill chain, that still has that notion that there is some sort of almost conveyor belt type of activities. And don't get me wrong, I'm a massive fan of MITRE ATT&CK and similar frameworks. But it is very easy to get sort of in the kind of thinking that there is a very predictable pattern or set of patterns that you just need to be able to control. And of course, that's not always how it works in reality. But another thing, testing, even if we test like maybe in a sort of offensive, destructive way, let's say pen testing, red teaming, we're still very much, very often focused on doing that in an almost isolated way. A pen test is often done on maybe not even a production system with a very controlled set of accounts or credentials, really making sure that the impact is very much controlled. And then the test is done, the report is being handed over, and we release the system into the wild again, which, as we had seen with those complex system examples, it might behave in a completely different way than if you just look at it in a sort of a lab setting where you control everything that is happening. So how can we try to maybe change that and start to apply some, I guess, proactive braking, proactive wobbling, maybe proactive falling, if we want to stick to that cycling metaphor? I think the first one is to really start looking for ways where we can proactively provoke our environments, provoke our people and teams. So essentially creating those small events that will make us ready to hopefully prevent the bigger ones. And this has a lot of advantages, right? You build muscle memory. You build, yeah, you really train to be ready for these kind of situations, whether it's incident response and crisis readiness. But it will also show hidden dependencies that you might not be aware of. And one of the, of course, well-known examples, I've referred to this in earlier talks as well, is the chaos engineering concept. And I think Netflix is one of the big, one of the very well-known examples who apply this, where they deliberately break parts of their infrastructure to make sure that, yeah, both their systems and their teams are more ready to deal with these kinds of interruptions. And something like this is, of course, something where I think many of us can experiment more with. And there's Netflix publishes the software they use. You can of course download that and test that. But there's also other ways to do that within Azure. If you are in the Microsoft Cloud, you can also use the Azure Chaos Studio to run these kinds of little experiments. But there's really these kinds of ways to start provoking small parts of your environment to be ready, more ready for the bigger ones. And of course, it doesn't have to be full-blown chaos monkey to the next level initially. I think Netflix actually really describes that they have really good circuit breakers in place to make sure that these things, yes, they break things, but they do it in a controlled and in an intended way. We can start to experiment with this in smaller ways, where we say, okay, let's say this goes down, can we fail gracefully? Maybe by showing a message to our users, if we have a sort of an online presence, can we find dependencies we're not aware of? Things like if something goes down, we redirect people to our status page, which might have a dependency with the thing that went down. All these kinds of things, far better to, of course, experiment with in a somewhat controlled experiment rather than in a real incident. But of course, this can be done in other ways as well. If we think of security as building capacity, you see it as a bit of a muscle that needs to be trained. It can also be more tabletop style, where you do these things maybe in more of discussion context, maybe get a few of the relevant teams together, maybe a mix of IT and non-IT parts of the organization, and yeah, talk through. What if this part goes down? What if this supplier is not available? What if this part of the business or this part of the system is responding slowly? Can we predict or at least try to think of what might happen, and can we see if we're ready to deal with this? Another way is, of course, and I know many companies start doing this, is to do something similar, but then maybe focus more on incident response. So incident response, dress rehearsals, or maybe even broader game days where larger parts of the organization participate, to really make this something more than just something that the security team is focused on and is working on. And with that, yes, this will mean we break things. Don't break for the sake of breaking, of course. So the purpose is not create a report, haha, we got you, haha, the red team got to domain admin. That's, of course, not why we're doing this. We're doing this to make the organization, to make our systems better. So always have that fixing mindset in mind whenever you're trying to introduce these kinds of experiments into the organization. Second thing is to start building this learning part of the organization whenever something goes wrong. And what is going wrong actually in the first place? Because what you actually see in many instances is that it's the same behavior that leads to failure and to success. It is only in hindsight where we say, hey, there is something that went wrong. We label this an incident. And then we go back in time and we see behavior that is deviating from maybe our norms or whatever training instructions we have. But it's not the case that somebody, of course, at some point said, hey, this is a great day for my company to get hacked. Let me do something silly and click on the wrong things. That's not how these things happen. There was research that was done in a healthcare environment where they were looking into this behavior, where they were dealing with a situation where one in every 13 patient-doctor encounters resulted in an unwanted outcome. So something, I guess, similar to what we would label as an incident. So they started to investigate those cases, and they found that in those 1 in 13, there were things happening like miscommunication, and there were dose miscalculations, there were errors in operating piece of equipment, there were workarounds, so non-compliance leading to a bad outcome. Case closed. Until another research team started to look into those 12 other instances where the outcome was labeled to be good, where there was no incident. And what did they find? They found miscommunication, dose miscalculations, errors in operating a piece of equipment, workarounds. It is the same type of behavior, the messy reality, the messy interior of organizations, where these slight deviations from the training, from how we have instructed people, that is often actually the oil that makes our organizations work in the first place. That's also why things like these strikes where you are really adhering to the rules, the stiptheidsacties in Dutch, why they work so well. If everybody follows the instructions exactly to the letter, you see that organizations come to a standstill. If taxi drivers do that, for example, whole cities come to a grinding halt. So those slight deviations are what make organizations work in the first place. So whenever something happens that we label as an unwanted outcome, we need to try and investigate in a blameless way. And that's easier said than done, because you cannot just all of a sudden say, okay, we're blameless now. We're just going to look at what happened. Nobody's going to be made responsible. But it's really a matter of trying to ask questions like not who made the mistake, what rule was broken, but more things like, why or how did this make sense to this person at that point in time? And were there maybe any systemic pressure or weird incentives that led to this decision? And how can we maybe make that right choice easier the next time? So it's really trying to incorporate those kinds of questions and also be really conscious of how you position this and the words you use. So even something like a blameless investigation already sounds accusatory by itself. So yeah, maybe even frame it like, or label it like, it's a blameless study. Really small changes, but can really help to position how you are doing this. And all this is ultimately meant to understand better how work works, how work is being done in a certain way, why people are taking the shortcut across the grass instead of walking the long route on the pavement to get to the bus stop you see on the slide. And with that, refrain from our reflex to then say, okay, non-compliance, we need to put up a sign. If people still walk across the grass, maybe we need a fence. We need to make it higher if they step over it, maybe put barbed wire on top of it. No, if something like this happens, it is essentially the organization sending you a message and saying, okay, this was designed in a certain way, probably with the best intentions, but for whatever reason, it does not work as well in reality. And yeah, it's again those complex systems again. You think you have all the individual components lined up in order, but yeah, those messy people we all have in our organizations, of course, do sometimes things different than we intend. And we can even maybe make things going wrong sort of a celebration, or yeah, organize things like, let's have a monthly fail fest or whatever you want to call it, where people actually, and I think it was at camp here as well, share your best failure and together talk through what you learned and how we can all benefit from it, and maybe how we now have learned something that the competition doesn't know. Really try to celebrate these kinds of things, because there are numerous examples where, of course, great ideas actually originated from something that initially was labeled as an experiment that went wrong or something that did not go as intended. Or as Roger Federer reminded us all about in the commencement speech that you might have seen about a year ago. In his tennis matches, he only won 54% of the points, and he greatly elaborated on how you then, of course, if you only win so few of your points, yeah, how you cannot do anything else than really put those points behind you and only see them not as a failure, but as something where you have to learn from and where you have to almost forget and try to do better the next time. And yeah, this is, of course, something where, again, we are decades behind other industries, which have a far more mature, far more systematic way of doing these kinds of things. Whenever there's an incident, we try to describe what happened so that the whole industry can learn from it. And as long as we still have those headlines where we are all blame why an organization was victim to criminals, mind you, it was not necessarily something they did wrong in the first place. As long as we stick to that victim blaming, we're still far away from the maturity that, for example, the airline industry has here. And the third component is then to build, and that's of course closely related, to build an environment where it is felt as safe to speak up about near misses or maybe even things that really went wrong, and where people feel it is necessary to do that because you are asking good questions to get to the bottom of this and try to understand why something happened in a certain way. And you have to show that you really make it worthwhile, show that you act on what you learn, and you're not just doing this for the books to get some sort of compliance check mark, but that you're really trying to see how can we learn from this, how can we change the organization. And here, maybe there's things like doing a sort of a team or organization assessment check that you can do, asking questions like, okay, how do we think we're doing here? Do people actually come to the security team with their sort of, ooh, I just in time spotted this weird link, or I clicked on this link, can you guys help me out? And do maybe more junior colleagues, do they actually challenge decisions by more senior people in the organization? And can they? Is it allowed to say, I don't know? Is that an acceptable answer? And do people feel safe to experiment? Good to ask these types of questions and be brutally honest to see how do we actually think we're doing in this space. And this doesn't come naturally to security teams, right? I think this is really where we have to change the mindset from this department of no that was already referred to in the intro to sort of the team of hell yeah, where everybody thinks like, okay, if there is something that sits a little bit on that boundary between technology and the real world, then probably security is actually the place to go to because they really think along, they help you, they are not accusatory, really be that supporting team that's not just saying, if you are reporting a phishing email, you're not get that angry phone call back to say, you forgot to include header information, now we can't do anything with it. No, it really helped people to build that culture where people are supporting the security team and are working alongside with you. So a few more other tools to close off that we should keep in mind. And I think the most important one, if you have those three building blocks, is to keep thinking in that system of systems way of dealing with challenges. So not just test like only the bicycle parts. Does the bell work? Have we oiled the keychain? Are the tires really, do they have the right pressure? No, really look at it from an overall perspective. So if there is a vulnerability, don't just look at a CVE score to say how serious it is. No, try to incorporate other tooling like how exploitable is it? How exploitable is it in my environment? Yeah, and really try to look at it also here from a more systemic perspective than just in an isolated absolute truth. And this is even more important when it comes to third parties, supply chain, whatever you want to call it. So don't just send other organizations you work with the standard 100 question Excel spreadsheet with your security questions where they, of course, say yes to everything because they want to work with you. But What happens if a third party has an incident? Will they actually call you to inform you, or have you agreed on incentives that actually make it so that they will probably try to fix it quietly first? Maybe you've agreed on some sort of penalty if there's an incident. Well, then they're probably not going to pick up the phone first thing to tell you. And it's really this kind of thinking, is it a supplier or is it a partner? And procurement, of course, has agreed it's a supplier, and they've sort of agreed on a low price that goes down every year, squeezing last nickel out of your supplier. But whenever you have an incident, then you want a partner, then you want Rolls-Royce service, then you want to be shoulder to shoulder in the trenches. You can't have it both if you haven't thought of this beforehand, and even better, if you have tested this together with them. And maybe we should also actually hold back a little bit every now and then, and maybe remove some rules, maybe remove some instructions, remove traffic signs like is done in Amsterdam behind Central Station. Because if a situation actually feels a little bit unsafe and a little bit unclear, people lower their speed. They make eye contact. They sort of jointly agree, okay, shall I go first? Oh no, you go first. And maybe we should actually also look for these kinds of things instead of fall into our reflex of keep adding more and more measures all the time. And again, here there's research in other disciplines that supports this. Woolworths, a supermarket chain in Australia, ran an experiment when they were seeing that their safety numbers had more or less plateaued. They felt like they kept investing, but they weren't really getting any better in their safety records. So they asked the university team to help them analyze this, and they divided a number of stores that were very similar into three groups. One didn't change anything, was the control group. One where they took away pretty much all of the compliance safety rules that were there, except the ones that they were really couldn't take away because of legal reasons. And the third one, where they again also took away all those rules, but they also gave the staff training in this safety to resilience way of thinking. And what they found was that those latter two groups, where the rules had been removed, performed far better. Business was running better, safety records were improving, people felt far more ownership, because of course they had more ownership. They were actually trusted to make the right decisions and do the right things. So it was an experiment where they really felt like taking away things actually leads to better outcome. And this is really, again, where our way of thinking of adding more layers, having layers of defense, which quickly can become layers of excuse or layers that make us slow, is really something where we should keep thinking how we can remove some things instead of continuously adding more. And finally, one more thing. I think if there's one area where this way of thinking, and especially this complex system notion, is important, and I don't want to be sort of the hype doctor, but it is everything related to the crazy AI things that are happening everywhere. And whether you are positive about them, negative, agree or not, I don't really care. But I think what a lot of these systems do have in common is that it's even harder to predict how they will happen just by looking at the individual components. They have even more those characteristics of the emergent behavior, the unpredictable outputs, the constant adaptation. So I think the organizations that will be most ready to deal with this are the ones that keep this way of thinking in mind and don't just think that they can just regulate AI into a square box again, because I think that is not necessarily going to work. So that's great, another sort of mindset, how we need to keep thinking talk. We're back in our business maybe tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, after the weekend. What do we do? Well, I think if we can all just start small, that will already be a big change. So even if it's just one process to remove instead of adding something new, or one failure to celebrate instead of looking to find the culprit, or if it's just one junior colleague's voice that we amplify instead of holding them down in sort of the corporate bureaucracy, or one system interaction to test instead of just looking at the individual components. I think that would already be really great. So probably you might still remember who helped you when you first learned to balance, how we mastered this art of continuously falling on the bikes. And what I've tried to show is some ways where wobbling actually helps, how we have these controlled ways of falling, where we, how we should accept that we might fall, and that small falls might actually be beneficial, and that paradoxically those few more small incidents might actually lead to fewer bigger incidents. So I won't hold you all back from trying these things. We all shouldn't hold each other back from taking this wobbly first step. So when we all get back to our organizations and our teams, just find our own pelotons of cyclists, get on the bikes, wobble our way and draft off each other's strengths, and keep failing, keep wobbling, but do it on purpose. Thanks very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Jelle Niemann-Sverdjit. We still have a few minutes left for a quick Q&A. There is a microphone in the room where someone is already waiting. Let me get back up. I also want to ask first if there is a question from the online channels, from our Signal Angel in the back. Do you have any questions? Does not, someone is waving? No, there is no questions. Then please ask your question.
Hello. Yeah. So I've been working in organizations where we celebrate our failures, so I know all about it.
Yeah.
We had a report from the Dutch Security Office for Military recently in the spring, and they warned for AI tooling being used for finding really fast the a patch and how to use a patch and then attack based on the vulnerability that's supposed to be solved. So you can, in 10 minutes, half an hour, you will be already vulnerable for attacks. So my initial thought was, okay, that we can only fix that by adding a few more layers to our systems in preventing, you know, being, you don't know where the attacks comes from, you don't have the time to fix it, you cannot patch within half an hour, that's organizational very difficult. So, but then you say, don't put many layers. So now I'm sort of conflicting. What's your thought on that?
Ooh, it's and it's probably not necessarily adding more layers. Probably more subtle than just taking everything away, right? But I'm trying to think what would be a good way to deal with these scenarios. Maybe it is. Maybe if you think more about the sort of the provoking mindset, maybe that actually might be a way to test what is the best approach there. If you, in your example, if you are assuming that some AI generated vulnerability is coming towards your environment, maybe you can actually then try to run a chaos style experiment to try and predict, or at least see how that could spread through the environment, and use that to come up with clever, well, maybe indeed barriers or other ways to detect and hopefully prevent that from getting to the more serious part of the organization. But yeah, no, I agree. It's not necessarily saying just get rid of all the layers and make it sort of a very flat flat infrastructure, so to say. That's
There's another question.
Yes, I do have a question. I'm from ZCERT. I'm the process manager from the internal incidents, and I was wondering how you look at like sharing with the post-mortem. Like, we internally are pretty open about it to our own employees, but how would you encourage, or like, what's your opinion about like talking it openly and maybe sharing it wider, because there's a lot of TLP involved usually, and how do you think that we could probably Yeah, get further into it. Because I think like sharing knowledge is a good thing, but there are so many obstacles in that.
Yeah, and I'm a big supporter of sharing more, and I'm disappointed that we still find it so hard to talk about these things. And of course, there might be sensitivities and legal reasons where it at least initially might not be possible. But I think after a little bit of time has passed, why are we still so reluctant? And I mean, there's good. When I was working at Verizon, we started the data breach investigations report, where we at least try to overcome this by saying, if people don't want to share their individual case, then at least let's all throw them together at a big pile and look at overall trends. That's a little bit, that helps a bit. But yeah, it's I'm positively, I think, especially in the Netherlands, that we have now had a few good examples, especially some of the universities, which of course were very open sharing their incident reports. I think it should ultimately become normal. And let's not forget, in many cases, of course, there are always things that they could have done better, but in the first place, you're still a victim of, in many cases, a criminal or a state-sponsored organization. You're a victim. And whenever the newspaper shop at the end of your street is being robbed, then the first thing many of us will do is say, oh, I'm really sorry that happened. Can I help you with something? And we're not saying, why didn't you have an anti-tank barrier and a gun behind the counter? We're saying, yeah, we're really sorry that you're a victim. And yeah, I think more compassionate response is also warranted in these situations.
Is there another question in the room?
Maybe
from online. Is there a question? Does not look like
maybe
it.
Some closing thoughts. I'm at best an enthusiastic amateur in many of what I've been talking about. I mean, I come from cybersecurity myself, but there's a lot of books and there's some examples on the screen that I really benefited from. I think especially the work from Sydney Decker, whose books you see on the left, is very strong on everything related to safety too. And safety science, but Kelly Shortridge's Security Chaos Engineering is also a big recommendation. And should you not be much of a reader, Sydney Decker actually also has a number of small documentaries on his website where he, for example, describes some of those experiments like the one at Woolworths and some others and in the healthcare sector. So yeah, those are surely recommended if you want to know more about some of the ideas that underpin what I've been talking about. So with that, I guess thank you all again and have a great rest of the night.
Thank you so much. Please, a big applause for Jelle.